Okay. Good morning. It looks like we're all here today, and I'll ask the marshal to announce the hearing, please.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bradfold, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Judge Bradfold presiding.
All right, and good morning. Today's date is October 20th, 2020, and we are here for the rescheduled argument. I'll have the marshal call the case number in just a moment. But I just wanted to advise counsel, I'm sure you're wondering, you have two judges, not three in front of you. And it just so happens that Judge Kirk, and we're not exactly sure why, but is unavailable this morning. Of course, we do record this argument. And so just as we would for another judge who is ill, we will make sure that Judge Siegel gets Judge Kirk gets a chance to listen to the argument and participate in that way. Maybe that he will join us during the course of the argument because it may well be a technical issue. He is would be joining us remotely, and we all know that that happens. So with that, I will ask the marshal to call the rescheduled case today. Go right ahead with the file number and the name of the parties, please.
Now calling A19-20-2080, State of Minnesota v. Brennan Reynolds.
Right. And I see that we have counsel here for this matter. And I assume that you are familiar with our new procedures as a result of the pandemic. So we are all appearing remotely via Zoom. Most things are the same. We ask you to identify yourself for the record, as well as the client that you represent. And then we will proceed with the argument. I know we got a request from appellant's counsel to alter the presentation today and go so reserve all your time on the backside, but we don't really proceed that way. If you choose not to use your entire 15 minutes, that's just fine, but you're going to be allowed 15 minutes at the front end and 5 at the back. Did you want to say something, Mr. Rehnquist?
Oh, just to make sure. Yeah. I'm not 100%. I'm not in front of this particular court much.
Yeah.
Can I, you said 15 and 5, but so I have 20 minutes total?
That's correct.
Can I have any more than 5 minutes for rebuttal if I take it out of my presentation time?
No.
Ah, fair enough. Well, thank you.
I mean, if you have a strong feeling about this sort of thing, you can definitely proceed by motion before the argument, and then it is something that the panel will consider together and resolve. But right now, we're going to proceed on our standard allocation of time, which is 15 and 5. Like I said, you're not required to take all of either side. All right, I just wanted to say one more thing before we start the timer and proceed with the argument. So I've mentioned to you to identify yourself for the record, as well as the client you represent. And then I want to make sure both sides, you do see the clock that's now available on the screen. Is that right? So you keep an eye on the 15 minutes. And Mr. Rehnquist, thank you very much for rescheduling today and for letting us know your current health concerns. And so please, if there's any way we can accommodate them during the course of the argument, let us know that. But with that, I think we're ready to proceed. So Mr. Rehnquist, you are the appellant. You have 15 minutes for your opening remarks. Thank you.
To the Honorable Judge Siegel, to the Honorable Judge Bradvolt, to the Honorable Judge Kirk, who we hope will be here soon or will see this soon enough, and to my esteemed colleague and opponent, Ms. Dolan, good morning. If it pleases you, my name is Casey Thompson Rehnquist. I represent Brendan Jamel Reynolds, who is the appellant in this court and who was the defendant in the district. We come before your honor to present what we believe is an incredibly simple case. Brendan Reynolds was arrested on September 17th, 2018. There was no Terry stop. There was no traffic stop for an equipment violation or a speeding violation. Before law enforcement even knew his name, much less if he had a permit to carry a pistol. They stopped him. They ordered him out of the car. They made him walk backwards towards them. Multiple uniformed officers, guns drawn, pointed at my client. Fear, anxiety, near to death if he had made a misstep, but he didn't. He did everything he was required to and asked of. He walked backwards until the officers could be comfortable. They placed him in handcuffs. They made him wait around in handcuffs for a short period of time. And only then did they search him. And when they searched him, they found what they allege is a firearm. Okay, fair enough. With those facts and consulting with the cases that I have cited in my brief, undisputably, State versus Blackstone, State versus Carver, if police are to enact a felony traffic stop, guns drawn, handcuffs coming out of the pocket, defendant's hands upon his head, moving backwards, handcuffed and then searched, they must show probable cause. I don't think that they did show probable cause, and if the court wants me to get into that with questions, I certainly will. But the bottom line here is the district court just applied the wrong standard. Terry is not the standard for a felony stop. I don't believe there is any case law that says that. We have Carver and we have Blackstone that we can consult with, and they are indisputable black letter law that says probable cause is the standard. And as a result, with the most respect that I may offer to all three of you and to Ms. Hino, to thank you for allowing my question to be posed, and to Judge Kirk, who we hope to see soon, I don't know that there's much else I can say. Are there any questions?
So just one question. So there is case law saying that if there's evidence that there's a gun likely involved in the stop, guns drawn, doing a felony kind of stop, doesn't necessarily take it out of Terry and into probable cause. So how do you respond to that? And then where should that line be drawn? Because it, you know, there's, you know, Carver that deals with a speed, you know, the stop was for speeding, you know, compared to some of the other cases where, you know, like Ballinger, where there was a tip that the person was armed and it shot off his gun. So would address that just for a minute. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yes, happily. And I will say, I don't have Ballinger here at my fingertips, but the way you described it, if it's a tip that, okay, so if it is a tip that an individual has been firing off a gun, then that's very different, because if you're firing off a gun, you're almost, it's impossible, at least if you're in a major city, an urban center, or even a suburban center. If you're out in the country, it might be different. If you're in a major city, if you're firing off a gun, or if there's reasonable articulable suspicion thereof, then you're almost certainly violating any number of city ordinances and probably some state laws that I'm not terribly familiar with. So of course, in that instance, police are correct to use the Terry tool. But the broader question that you're asking is about drawing a line. And I think that the most reasonable thing I can suggest is there needs to be a tailoring of the amount of police force related to the amount of suspicion. So again, I think that your question is already answered by Blackstone and Carver. I really do. Those two cases should pretty much be the end of this discussion, with all due respect. But when we wanted to, it seems like you're also wanting to talk, Your Honor, about policy a little bit. And I'm happy to do it, because it is, of course, crucial that law enforcement have the tools that are reasonable and acceptable to get unlawful firearms off the street. But the problem is that is a huge and thorny debate that starts to get to the case that is lurking behind us right now, deep in the shadows in the dark, but not too far from us. Lurking in the shadows is State versus Williams, cited in my brief. The Minnesota Supreme Court has thus far refused to answer the question of what really is probable cause when what police are engaged in is trying to investigate or detain someone who they believe is in possession of a pistol, but they don't know whether or not that person has a permit. What Williams and the case that it cites to basically say is that, sure, reasonable articulable suspicion in that case means that police don't need to be assured that the individual has or doesn't have a permit before they enact a Terry stop. But the reason that Williams is not directly apostate here is that all these cases that Your Honor, with due respect, Your Honor Siegel, Judge Siegel, that you are talking about, those are Terry cases. This is not a Terry case because this was not a Terry stop. This was a felony stop. Guns drawn, hands behind your back, walk backwards, multiple uniformed officers, guns pointed at my client. He could have been killed if he had made a misstep, but he did not. And with all due respect, Black Lives Matter, George Floyd's life mattered, Brendan Reynolds' life still matters. If police want to apply to the point of pointing firearms within a hair's breadth of applying deadly force to someone who they have not even yet identified. Because remember, these police didn't even know my client's name when they did that. All they knew that he was a guy who one ATF agent who was not credible. We suggest that agent was not credible. And you can see in my brief, because I found an inconsistency in his testimony that the court directly ignored. But if they are to do that, guns drawn at the point of death to kill a young Black man, by God, Your Honor, by God, Your Honor, by God, my esteemed co-counsel, the bare minimum we can ask of them is probable cause. Are there any other questions?
So, counsel, I just want to make sure, I think I do understand your point. Thank you for explaining it. If these officers had approached the vehicle, you're differentiating the felony stop from a Terry stop. And if they had approached the vehicle with one officer or two officers, but no guns drawn, you would not be making the argument you are today. That would have been an appropriate stop given their prior observation of Mr. Reynolds in possession of a weapon and our existing Minnesota case law.
I'm just trying to understand.
Yeah.
I do not so stipulate because I think that the state's presentation was so weak that they did not even meet the reasonable articulable suspicion standard.
Okay. But, then I'll just ask you to assume that if you would in answering my question, assume that the officers did have reasonable articulable suspicion that Mr. Reynolds was in possession of a gun. And as we know, our case law doesn't require the officers to ascertain whether he has a permit. So they would have had sufficient, would they have had a reasonable basis for a Terry stop in that
sense? Yes.
Okay.
The answer to your question, based on my understanding of the law and in this hypothetical that, of course, is not the facts of our case, but in the hypothetical, Yes, of course. And I think that basically that's just what the State versus Williams said. And obviously we're not here today to try to overturn State versus Williams because we do not have the power to do so. And I'm not asking the court to do that. I'm just asking the court to send this case back down to the district court and tell the district court to apply the appropriate standard, probable cause. Anything else?
Judge Siegel?
So the inconsistency, can you highlight that for me?
Okay, so I will cite, I have my brief up now, so I'm no longer looking at your honor's faces and Ms. Dolan's face, but I have it up. And when I go to, we start at page 6, and page 6 is where we start to examine Special Agent Nicholas McAdams' testimony. And the third sentence, I believe, of the last full paragraph reads, that Agent McAdams' testimony was he observed appellant, quote, sitting at the table with what I thought appeared to be a firearm in his pocket. And then I cite to the transcript at page 33. And then we go down, still on page 6, the next paragraph is cross-examination. On cross, he says he sees appellant standing by the house. So I confronted him with what I saw, thought was an inconsistency, because on cross, he first says standing, but in his direct, he says sitting at a table. So then I quote page 6 going into page 7. Confronted with this test with his testimony on direct that he saw appellant sitting at a table, McAdams says, I don't think I saw him sitting at a table. Transcript at page 37. And then I say, cite to transcript at page 33, and I quote him his direct testimony. And the quote that I found, and I think this is right because I do know how to read a transcript despite my diagnosis, I say, so I observed, I quote him as saying, so I observed the defendant sitting at the table with what I thought appeared to be a firearm at his pocket. So McAdams has said two separate and inconsistent things. One is that he was sitting at a table, one that he was standing, and he was unable to reconcile those two things. And then I point out some other problems with McAdams' testimony. The next sentence of my brief, we're still on page 7, first full paragraph, I say, McAdams also agreed that he can be heard on Exhibit 1, a body camera recording stating, quote, guy possibly looked like he had something coming out of his pocket. And he also said on cross, and I quote, I couldn't see a distinct firearm, and I could just tell it was a hard, heavy object with distinct hard corners. So he makes McAdams made in his testimony, as he's entitled to do, an inference that those, the object with the hard corners is a gun. Well, ladies and gentlemen, here's my cell phone. Object with hard corners can be held in a pocket. There's no way to exclude that it was a cell phone. And now I'm going to end by singing you a song from Bruce Springsteen. Is it a gun? Is it a knife? It is your wallet. This is your life. It ain't no secret. It ain't no secret. No secret, my friend. You can get killed just for living in. Brendan Reynolds could have gotten killed just for living in his American skin. I didn't cite that song in my brief, but it's called 41 Shots by Bruce Springsteen. It's one of my favorite songs, and now you have a little bit of it. I have a minute left. Any more questions? I yield. Ms. Dolan, give me your best shot, because I am not throwing away my shot.
So thank you, Mr. Rehnquist. And with that, we are ready to proceed with the respondent's argument. Ms. Dolan, if you are ready, you can go ahead as soon as the clock is reset, which it is just as I spoke. So whenever you're ready, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Appellant is asking this court to find that the district court erred by using a reasonable articulable suspicion standard to handcuff and detain the appellant because that exceeds the more limited searches and seizures in traffic stops and other investigative functions. The appellant's attorney has significantly omitted the totality of circumstances that the court has found must be analyzed in finding reasonable articulable suspicion. And those facts were the police were investigating a homicide that occurred earlier in the morning. They were called to a home where an impromptu wake was being held. There were lots of foot traffic. There were lots of people there. And Agent McAdams, who the district court did find credible, a Marine, former Marine, and an ATF agent familiar with firearms, made observations from just a half a block away using binoculars. And whether Mr. Reynolds was standing or sitting is really not relevant. He made his observations. He believed the appellant was in possession of a firearm. and he gave detailed information about what he saw, including the fact that at one point the pouch pocket opened and he could see a black or a dark object. And to be distinguished from a phone, he also testified that the object appeared very heavy. And I believe he did testify that a person wouldn't be holding their cell phone in the way that appellant was holding this object, and that it was cumbersome. He gave a detailed description to the police, the St. Paul police, and they were concerned about this firearm because they were investigating a homicide, that in fact, this firearm could somehow be tied to the homicide investigation. The district court also found Sergeant Moore's credible testimony. He said that it was important to recover any firearms because they could be tied to the homicide. And based on the totality of the circumstances, the collective knowledge of the police, and the action of his detention, the police were justified in stopping the vehicle. They conducted a limited and a brief investigatory stop that the duration of which was about 5 minutes. They had reasonable right. They had absolutely right under our case law that when a suspect is considered armed and dangerous, they can stop the vehicle with guns drawn in the interest of their safety as well as the safety of others. And when Mr. Moore, I'm sorry, when the appellant came out of his vehicle, he denied having a handgun. And yet after a search of his groin area, police did in fact find a gun. They had reasonable articulable suspicion to search him for the information that they had, but they also are justified in making the felony stop under these circumstances. And it wasn't until they discovered the gun that he was formally placed under arrest.
excuse me one moment. If we could just pause the argument, thank you. All right. I apologize. Go right ahead.
Thank you. So in terms of the Terry standard, the Terry standard applies in any situation where the police believe that criminal activity may be afoot and where they believe the suspect is armed and possibly dangerous.
So, counsel, I need to ask, you have emphasized twice now that police were entitled to proceed as they did in part because they had a basis for determining that Mr. Reynolds was armed. And you've talked about the officer's observations about that during the wake. And then also that he was dangerous. So you seem to be implying that he's dangerous because of the homicide investigation that was ongoing. I'm not sure I follow your reasoning, and maybe I misunderstand you. Maybe you have a different reason for arguing that the officers were justified to believe that Mr. Reynolds was dangerous. So explain that, please.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe under the circumstances of this investigation, that the officers could believe that anybody leaving that scene connected to the parties that were there, when they're armed, they can be dangerous. And that's the basis of my argument. Essentially, that anytime anybody has a firearm in a place where conceivably, that firearm could have been used at that scene. Now, maybe I speculate Mr. The appellant thought that he needed protection and that's why he brought it there. But at any rate, I do believe that the case law indicates that the appellant could be considered to be armed and dangerous in the context of the homicide investigation.
And you think your strongest case for that is what? That, and again, I'm just trying to get you to respond directly to appellant's yeah. argument, which is that the level of force in the stop is what was inappropriate. So it seems to me you are arguing that it's because Mr. Reynolds, officers had a basis for believing Mr. Reynolds to be armed and dangerous. You say that's all about him being armed. So then they were justified in the multiple officers gun drawn felony stop scenario. So what's your strongest case to support that?
Well, the police are justified in when they believe criminal activity is afoot to proceed with weapons ready. Now, Mr. Reynolds may not have done anything that could be considered dangerous. He didn't fire the gun. He wasn't seen pointing at anyone. And the recovery of this firearm was paramount. So it may be that basically the search yielded this firearm. They had reason to search him for the firearm, independent of whether or not they considered him dangerous.
Is that just because he was at the house? And is that just because he was at the house that was associated with this homicide victim?
I believe the transcript said that both the decedent and the victim were associated with this particular address. The fact that rather more than the dangerous aspect, it's an ongoing investigation of a homicide. And Sergeant Moore carefully articulated that he thought they were justified in stopping him in light of the fact that the appellant was seen with the firearm, or what an experienced officer believed was a firearm. And in the context of this homicide investigation, he testified that guns are frequently passed from person to person, and it was reasonable for them to believe possibly that this weapon was involved in the homicide. So no, there's nothing specific that Mr. Reynolds did that could be considered dangerous. However, it was of paramount concern for the police to recover any firearm that may be associated with the homicide.
So I'm still looking for Ms. Dolan for the Minnesota case law that you think best supports that argument, so that where there's an ongoing homicide investigation, a weapon is missing, and officers see someone loosely, obviously, associated with the homicide, because we have no link between Mr. Reynolds and the homicide itself. We do know that he was present at this wake of one of the victims. So in that scenario, that officers are entitled not just to conduct a brief investigative Terry stop with weapons ready, but they're actually able to have those weapons drawn, multiple officers. So would you help me with what you think is the closest Minnesota case, or are you telling us we're writing on a blank slate here?
Well, as far as a homicide investigation, I don't think I saw any of the case law. There was the case involving, I believe it was Williams, where the firearm was observed. There have been cases where a citizen observes a firearm. There's nothing, there was nothing in that case, and forgive me, I'm not able to pull that site.
Are you thinking of Timberlake? Is that what you're thinking?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, okay.
So in Timberlake, it was the mere observation of a firearm. And the fact that the police were able to corroborate, there was reliability to that tip. the car that was stopped matched the description of the car. The defendant in that case matched the description. So it doesn't necessarily have to be dangerousness associated with a brief investigatory stop to determine whether or not the person had a firearm in possession.
Right. And so you would compare the stops that were conducted in Williams and Timberlake with the stop in this case. You think it's the same?
I would, Your Honor, yes.
Okay, even though there are differences, obviously, in the number of officers and the approach.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think there were two in Timberlake, and there may have been more in Williams since they were, in fact, investigating. I believe that was the case where they investigating an aggravated robbery that had taken place. And there was also the case involving the welfare of GM, where a minor had a gun and where the officer observed unusual conduct, not necessarily criminal conduct, not necessarily dangerous conduct. But again, the officer's experience and training led him to believe that that GM may in fact have been armed.
And the standard applied, I'm not as familiar with the welfare of GM. The standard applied in that case was probable cause, reasonable articulable suspicion.
What? It was reasonable articulate suspicion.
And I take it from your argument that you think the district court analyzed this case correctly and it was reasonable articulable suspicion that was required.
Yes, and the appellant sort of skipped the reasonable. It's a puzzle that fits together. You have to have the reasonable articulable suspicion to briefly detain the appellant. It's our position that if a gun hadn't been found, that there would have been no arrest, no charges. But once the gun was found, then there was probable cause. You don't need probable cause, as appellant argues, to search somebody. You only need probable cause to arrest them. That you don't need probable cause to briefly detain somebody to conduct a brief investigation.
And you are not arguing that the officers had probable cause at the onset of the stop, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. So the state is asking that you affirm the district court's findings in this case. They were not clearly erroneous, nor was the application of law. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So Mr. Rehnquist, the marshal is resetting the clock. There you have it, 5 minutes. So you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. I'm going to do two things that might look and seem a little unusual. And so if you make you uncomfortable, I'm sorry. And of course you will tell me to stop. First, we, the appellants, would very much like a published opinion in this case, not an unpublished opinion. And second, here's the last thing that I have to say.
Take that ride.
So, Mr. Rehnquist, I do actually really enjoy Bruce Springsteen's music, so I'm familiar with the song. Thank you. As far as this court publishing a case, that is an appropriate point to make during oral argument. You can also make it in your brief. Here's what we ask in response, which is, what is the syllabus point that you would suggest that we embrace in a published opinion in this case? Have you had time to give that some thought?
Well, I don't know what a syllabus point is, but I think I can answer.
Well, think of it as the holding of the case. Well, you know, you're familiar with our case law, Timberlake, mm-hmm. Williams, and the other cases that you've mentioned. What is the holding that this court should adopt in a published opinion in this case?
If law enforcement chooses to enact a felony stop, then they must have probable cause. And that's it. Now, it's a little tricky because the term felony stop is not, I don't think, precisely defined in case law. But colloquially, I don't think we have any confusion about what a felony stop is. It involves no additional investigation before guns are drawn, before handcuffs are taken out, before orders are issued, before defendants are told to perhaps kneel on the ground, or even taken into a squad car. I think we all know what a felony stop is. It's a colloquial term that is used in every district court in suppression hearings. This was clearly a felony stop. And as a result, there should have been, the district court should have required a showing of probable cause. It did not. The district court ignored and minimized my arguments. It did not engage with the material that I presented. As a result, the remedy should be a remand to ask the court to actually take a look at what I was arguing and not simply take the easy way out. Any other questions?
Judge Siegel?
No, I don't have additional questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Rehnquist. You have completed your remarks then today, I assume?
I have. Thank you.
Okay. Yep. No, and our thanks to both lawyers in this case. We very much appreciate you presenting this matter to us today and very much appreciate your appearance today for argument, because it is through our conversation that we often learn things that we otherwise might not learn through the course of reading the briefs and the record in the case. And so with that, this matter is now submitted to the court for its decision. As I previously explained, of course, this argument was recorded, and Judge Kirk will have the opportunity to hear it before the court conducts its conference and reaches a decision. But